of a Nigerian girl, alive and standing in one's own garden. Governments may deny such things or brush them off as statistical anomalies, but human beings cannot. I sat at the kitchen table and stared through suddenly wet eyes at the stump where my finger used to be. I realized that it was finally time to face up to what had happened on the beach. It should never have happened, of course, in the ordinary run of things. There are countries of the world and regions of one's own mind where it is unwise to travel. I have always thought so, and I have always struck myself as a sensible woman, independent of mind, but not recklessly so. I would love to have the same arm's-length relationship with foreign places that other sensible women seem to have. Clever me, I went on holiday somewhere different. That season in Nigeria there was an oil war. Andrew and I hadn't known. The struggle was brief, confused, and scarcely reported. The British and Nigerian governments both deny to this day that it even took place. God knows they aren't the only ones who tried denial. I still wonder why it came into my head to accept a holiday in Nigeria. I wish I could claim it was the only tourist board freebie that arrived at the magazine that spring, but we had boxes full of them, crates of unopened envelopes hemorrhaging sunscreen from ruptured sample sachets. I could have chosen Tuscany or Belize. The former Soviet states were big that season. But no. The cussed streak in me, the one that made me launch Nixie instead of joining some tamer glossy, the one that made me start an affair with Lawrence instead of mending my fences with Andrew, that enduring outward-bound streak gave me an adolescent thrill when a package landed on my desk emblazoned with the question, "For your holiday this year, why not try Nigeria?" Some wag on my editorial staff had scrawled under this, in black chunky marker, the obvious response. But I was intrigued, and I opened the package. Out fell two open-ended airline tickets and a hotel reservation. It was as simple as turning up at the airport with a bikini. Andrew came with me, against his better judgment. The Foreign Office were advising against travel to some parts of Nigeria, but we didn't think that included ours. He took some time convincing, but I reminded him that we'd taken our honeymoon in Cuba, and parts of that place were horrific. Andrew gave in. Looking back on it now, I suppose he thought he had no choice if he wanted to keep me. The tourist board that sent the freebies noted that Ibino Beach was an adventurous destination. Actually, at the time we went, it was a cataclysm with borders. To the north there was a malarial jungle, and to the west a wide brown river delta. The river was iridescent with oil. It was, I now know, bloated with the corpses of oil workers. To the south was the Atlantic Ocean. On that southern edge I met a girl who was not my magazine's target reader. Little Bee had fled southeast on bleeding feet from what had once been her village and was shortly to become an oil field. She fled from the men who would kill her because they were paid to, and the children who would kill her because they were told to. I sat at my kitchen table, and I imagined her fleeing through the fields and the jungle as fast as she could, until she arrived at the beach where Andrew and I were being unconventional. That beach was as far as she got. My missing finger itched, just thinking about it. When they came in from the garden, I sent Batman to play in his Batcave, and I showed Little Bee where the shower was. I found some clothes for her. Later, when Batman was in bed, I made two G&Ts. Little Bee sat and held hers, rattling the ice cubes. I drank mine down like medicine. "All right," I said, "I'm ready. I'm ready for you to tell me what happened."
"You want to know how I survived?"
"Start from the beginning, will you? Tell me how it was when you first reached the sea." She told me how she had hid on the day she arrived at the beach. She had been running for 6 days, travelling through the fields by night and hiding in jungles and swamps when daybreak came. I turned off the radio in the kitchen, and I sat very quietly, while she told me how she holed up in a salient of jungle that grew right down to the sand. She lay there all through the hottest part of the day, watching the waves. She told me she hadn't seen the sea before, and she didn't quite believe in it. In the late afternoon, Little Bee's sister, Enkiruka, came down out of the jungle and found her hiding place. She sat down next to her. They hugged for a long time. They were happy that Enkiruka had managed to follow Little Bee's trail, but they were scared because it meant that others could do it too. Enkiruka looked into her sister's eyes and said that they must make up new names for themselves. It was not safe to use their true names, which spoke so loudly of their tribe and of their region. Enkiruka said her name was Kindness now. Her younger sister wanted to reply to Kindness, but she could not think of a name for herself. The two sisters waited. The shadows were deepening. A pair of hornbills came to crack seeds in the trees above their heads. And then, sitting at my kitchen table, she said she remembered this so clearly that she could almost reach out and stroke the fuzzy black back of the thing. A bee blew in on the sea breeze, and it landed between the two sisters. The bee was small, and it touched down on a pale flower. Frangipani, she told me, although she said she wasn't sure about the European name, and then the bee flew off again, without any fuss. She hadn't noticed the flower before the bee came, but now she saw that the flower was beautiful. She turned to Kindness. "My name is Little Bee," she said. When she heard this name, Kindness smiled. Little Bee told me that her big sister was a very pretty girl. She was the kind of girl the men said could make them forget their troubles. She was the kind of girl the women said was trouble. Little Bee wondered which it was going to be. The two sisters lay still and quiet till sunset. Then they crept down to the sand to wash their feet in the surf. The salt stung in their cuts, but they did not cry out. It was sensible of them to keep quiet. The men chasing them might have given up, or they might not. The trouble was, the sisters had seen what they had done to their village. There weren't supposed to be any survivors to tell the story. The men were hunting down the fleeing women and children and burying their bodies under branches and rocks. Back under cover, the girls bound each other's feet in fresh green leaves, and they waited for the dawn. It was not cold, but they hadn't eaten for 2 days. They shivered. Monkeys screamed under the moon. I still think about the two sisters there, shivering through the night. While I watched them in my mind, again and again, small pink crabs followed the thin smell of blood to the place where their feet recently stood in the shore break, but they do not find anything dead there yet. The soft pink crabs make hard little clicking noises under the bright white stars. One by one, they dig themselves back into the sand to wait. I wish my brain did not fill in the frightful details like this. I wish I was a woman who cared deeply about shoes and concealer. I wish I was not the sort of woman who ended up sitting at her kitchen table, listening to a refugee girl talking about her awful fear of the dawn. The way Little Bee told it, at sunrise there was a white mist hanging thick in the jungle and spilling out over the sand. The sisters watched a white couple walking up the beach. The language they spoke was the official language of Little Bee's country, but these were the first whites she had seen. She and Kindness watched them from behind a stand of palms. They drew back when the couple came level with their hiding place. The whites stopped to look out at the sea. Listen to that surf, Andrew, the white woman said. It's so unbelievably peaceful here.
I'm still a bit scared, frankly. We should go back inside the hotel compound.
The white woman smiled. Compounds are made for stepping outside. I was scared of you the first time I met you.
Course you were. Big Irish hunk of love like me. We're savages, don't you know?
Barbarians.
Vagabonds.
Cunts.
Oh, come on now, dear. That's just your mother talking.
The white woman laughed and pulled herself close to the man's body. She kissed him on the cheek.
I love you, Andrew. I'm pleased we came away. I'm so sorry I let you down. It won't happen again.
Really? Really. I don't love Lawrence. How could I? Let's make a fresh start,
On the beach, the white man smiled.
In the shadows, little Bee cupped her hand over Kindness's ear. She whispered,
What is a cunt?
Kindness looked back at her and rolled her eyes.
Right down there, girl. Right close to your vagabond.
Little Bee bit her hand so she wouldn't giggle. But then the sisters heard dogs. They could hear everything, because there was a cool morning breeze, a land breeze that carried all sounds. The dogs were still a long way off, but the sisters heard them barking. Kindness grabbed Little Bee's arm. Down on the beach, the white woman looked up at the jungle.
Oh, listen, Andrew, she said. Dogs.
Probably the local lads are hunting. Must be plenty to catch in this jungle.
Still, I wouldn't have thought they'd use dogs.
So what in the hell did you think they'd use?
The white woman shrugged. I don't know, she said. Elephants?
The white man laughed. You insufferable English, he said. The Empire's still alive for you, isn't it? You only need to close your eyes. Now a soldier came running up the beach from the direction the white couple had come. He was panting. He wore olive-green trousers and a light grey vest, dark with sweat. He had military boots on, and they were heavy with damp sand. He had a rifle slung on his back, and the barrel was swinging at the sky.
Oh, for fuck's sake, the white man said. Here comes that doofus of a guard again.
He's only doing his job.
Yeah, but can't they let us do our own thing even for 1 minute?
Oh, relax. The holiday was free, remember? We were never going to have it all our own way. The guard came level with the white couple, and he stopped. He was coughing. He had his hands on his knees.
Please, mister, miss us, he said. Sorry, please to come back to hotel compound.
But why? The white woman said. We were just going for a walk along the beach.
It is not safe, missus, the guard said. Not safe for you and mister. Sorry, boss.
But why? Said the white man. What is actually the problem?
No problem, said the guard. Here is very good place, very good. But all tourist must stay, please, in hotel compound.
Unseen in the jungle, the dogs were barking louder now. The sisters could hear the shouts of the men running with them. Kindness was trembling. The two sisters held each other. Now one of the dogs howled, and the others joined in. In the hiding place there was a splashing on the dry leaves and a smell of urine. The reality of Kindness's fear. Little Bee looked into her eyes. It didn't look as if her sister was even seeing her. Down on the beach, the white man was saying, Is this about money? And the guard was saying, No, mister. The guard stood up straight and looked into the jungle where the noise of the dogs was. He unslung his rifle. Little Bee saw the way he held it. He took the safety catch off, and he reached down to check the magazine. 2 magazines. I remember that myself, bound back to back with blue insulation tape.
The white man said,
Oh, don't give us the big performance. Just tell us how much you want. Come on. My wife is sick to the gills of being cooped up in that fucking compound. What will you take to let us go for a walk on our own? $1?
The guard shook his head. He wasn't looking at the white man. He was watching a flock of red birds flying up from the jungle 200 yards away.
$1, the guard said.
$10, then, the white woman said.
Oh, for the love of God, Sarah, the white man said. That is way too much. That's a week's wages here.
Don't be such a tight ass, the white woman said. What's $10 to us? It's nice to be able to do something for these people. God knows they have little enough.
Well, look then, $5, the white man said.
The guard was watching the treetops. 150 yards away, up a shallow gully, the tips of the palm ferns were twitching.
You come back with me now, the guard said. Hotel compound is best for you.
Listen, the white man said. I'm sorry if we offended you by offering money, and I respect you for not taking it. But I have my editor telling me what's best for me 51 weeks of the year. I didn't come here to have anyone edit my holiday.
The guard lifted the muzzle of his gun. He fired 3 shots in the air, just above the white man's head. The barking of the dogs and the yelling of the men stopped for a moment. Then they started again, louder. The white couple stood very still. Their mouths were open. They were struck, perhaps, by the bullets that had missed them.
"Please, Mr. and Mrs.," the guard said. "Trouble is come here. You not know my country."
The sisters heard the thwack of machetes clearing a path. Kindness grabbed little Bee's hand and pulled her to her feet. The 2 sisters walked out of the cover of the jungle and onto the sand. Holding hands, they stood there, looking up at the white man and the white woman, Andrew and me, in hope and expectation. I suppose there was nothing else in the developing world they could do. They stood on the sand clutching each other, keeping themselves upright on their failing legs, Kindness straining her head to watch for the approaching dogs, but little Bee looking steadily at me, ignoring Andrew, ignoring the guard.
"Please, missus," she said, "take us to the hotel compound with you."
The guard looked at her, then he looked back up at the jungle. He shook his head.
"Hotel compound is for tourists," he said, "not for you girls."
"Please," said little Bee, looking directly at me. "Bad men are hunting us. They will kill us."
She spoke to me as a woman, knowing I would understand. But I didn't understand. 3 days earlier, just before we left for Heathrow, I had been standing on a bare concrete slab in our garden, asking Andrew exactly when the hell he planned to build his bloody glasshouse there. That was the biggest issue in my life. That glasshouse, or the lack of it. That absent glasshouse, and all other structures past and future that might helpfully be erected in the larger emotional absence between me and my husband. I was a modern woman, and disappointment was something I understood better than fear. The hunters would kill her. My stomach lurched, but my mind still asserted it was just a figure of speech. "Oh, for goodness sake," I said, "you're a child. Why would anyone want to kill you?" Little Bee looked back at me and she said,
"Because we saw them killing everyone else."
I opened my mouth, but Andrew spoke first. I think he was suffering the same intellectual jet lag, as if our hearts had now arrived on the beach, but our minds were still hours behind. Andrew's eyes were terrified, but his voice said,
"This is fucking bullshit. This is a classic Nigeria scam. Come on, we're going back to the hotel."
Andrew started to pull me back along the beach. I went with him, twisting my head to look back at the sisters. The guard followed behind us. He walked backward and aimed his gun at the jungle. Little Bee followed with kindness, 10 yards behind.
the guard said.
You girls stop following us.
He pointed his gun at the sisters. They looked right back at him. The guard was slightly older than the girls, maybe 16 or 17, and he had a thin moustache. I suppose he was proud he could grow one. He had a green beret, and there was sweat trickling from under it. I could see the veins in his temples. The whites of his eyes were yellow.
Little B said, "What is your name, soldier?"
And he said,
"My name is, I will shoot if you don't stop following."
Little B shrugged and tapped her chest.
"My name is Little B," she said. "Here is my heart. Shoot here if you want."
And Kindness said, "Bullets is okay. Bullets is quick." They kept on following us along the beach. The guard's eyes went wide.
"Who is chasing you girls?"
"The same men who burned our village. The oil company's men."
The rifle began to shake in the guard's hand.
"Christ Jesus," he said.
There were men's shouts and dogs barking very loud now. I couldn't hear the surf any more. 5 brown dogs came out of the jungle running. They were mad from howling. Their sides and their paws were bleeding from the jungle thorns. The sisters screamed and ran past the guard. The guard stopped and he lifted his gun and he fired. The lead dog somersaulted over in the sand. His ear was shot off and a piece of his head too, I think. The pack of dogs skidded and stopped and they tore into the fallen dog. They were biting out chunks of the neck flesh while the back legs were still thrashing and twitching. I screamed. The guard was shaking. From out of the jungle 6 men came running. They wore tracksuit trousers, all torn, and vests and running shoes, gold chains. They moved quickly up on us. They ignored the dogs. One was holding a bow, holding it drawn. The others were waving their machetes, daring the guard to shoot. They came right up to us.
There was a leader. He had a wound in his neck. It was rotting. I could smell it. I knew he was going to die soon. Another of the men wore a wire necklace, and it was strung with dried brown things that looked like mushrooms. When he saw Kindness, this man pointed at her. Then he made circles on his nipples with his fingers, and he grinned. I am trying to report this as matter-of-factly as I know how. The guard said, "Keep walking, Mr. and Mrs." But the man with the neck wound, the leader, said,
"No, you stop."
"I will shoot," the guard said.
But the man said,
"Maybe you will get one of us, maybe two."
The man with the bow was aiming at the guard's neck, and he said,
"Maybe you get none of us. Maybe you should have shoot us when we was far away."
The guard stopped walking backward, and we stopped too. Little B and Kindness went around behind us. They put me and my husband between themselves and the hunters. The hunters were passing around a bottle of something I thought was wine. They were taking turns to drink. The man with the bow and arrows was getting an erection. I could see it under his tracksuit trousers. But his expression didn't change, and his eyes never moved from our guard's neck. He was wearing a black bandana. The bandana said Emporio Armani. I looked at Andrew. I tried to speak calmly, but the words were crushed in my throat. "Andrew," I said, "please give them anything they want." Andrew looked at the man with the neck wound, and he said,
"What do you want?"
The hunters looked at one another. The man with the neck wound stepped up to me. His eyes flickered, rolled up inside his head, then snapped back down and stared madly at me, the pupils tiny and the irises bullet-hard and gleaming like copper. His mouth twitched from a smile to a grimace, to a cruel thin line, to a bitter and amused disdain. The emotions played across his face like a television flipped impatiently between channels. I smelled his sweat and his rot. He made a sound,
an involuntary moan which seemed to surprise him. His eyes went wide, and he tore off my beach wrap. He looked down at the pale lilac material in his hands, curiously, and seemed to be wondering how it had got there. I screamed and clasped my arms over my breasts. I cringed away from the man, from the way he looked at me, now patiently, as if encouraging a slow learner, now furiously, now with pregnant vespertine calm. I was wearing a very small green bikini. I will say that again, and maybe I will begin to understand it myself. In the contested delta area of an African country in the middle of a three-way oil war, because there was a beach next to the war, because the State Tourist Board had mail-merged tickets for that beach to every magazine listed in the Writers and Artists Yearbook, because it was that year's cut, and because, as editor, I was first in the queue when distributors sent their own freebies to my magazine's office, I was wearing a very small green bandeau bikini from Hermès. It occurred to me, as I stood there with my arms crossed over my tits, that I had freeloaded myself to annihilation. The wounded man stepped so close to me that I felt the sand sink under my feet from his weight. He ran his finger over my shoulder, over my bare skin, and he said, "What do we want? We want to practice our English." The hunters exploded into laughter. They passed around the bottle again. For a moment, when one of them raised the bottle, I saw something with a pupil staring out of it. It was pressed up against the glass. Then the man put the bottle down, and the thing disappeared back into the liquid. I say liquid, because I didn't think it was wine any more. Andrew said, "We have money, and we can get more later." The wounded man giggled and made a noise like a pig, which made him giggle more. Then his face set suddenly into an expression of complete seriousness. He said, "You give me what you got now. There is no later." Andrew took his wallet from his pocket. He passed it to the wounded man. The man took it. His hand was shaking, and he pulled out the banknotes and threw the wallet down on the sand. He passed the money behind him to the men without looking or counting. He was breathing very heavily, and there was sweat running down his face. His neck wound was wide open. It was green-blue. It was obscene. I said, "You need medical attention. We could get help for you at the hotel." The man said, "Medicine not fix what these girls have seen. These girls got to pay for what they seen. Give me the girls." I said, "No." The wounded man looked at me, astonished.
"What you say?"
I said, "No. These girls are coming with us to the compound. If you try to stop them, our guard will shoot you." The wounded man widened his eyes in an indulgent simulacrum of fear. He put both his hands on the top of his head and turned himself through two shuffling circles on the sand. When he faced me again, he grinned and said,
"Where are you from, missus?"
"We live in Kingston," I said. The man cocked his head and looked interestedly at me. "Kingston upon Thames," I said. "It's in London." The man nodded.
"I know where Kingston is," he said. "I studied mechanical engineering there."
He looked down at the sand. He stood in silence for a moment. Then he moved, and it was very quick. I saw his machete go up. I saw the blade flash in the rising sun. I saw a tiny flinch. That was all the guard had time for. The blade went into the guard's throat, and it rang. It rang when it struck the bones of the neck. The metal was still ringing when the man yanked it out and the guard dropped into the sand. The blade rang, I remember, as if the machete was a bell and the guard's life was the clapper. The killer said,
"You ever hear a noise like that in Kingston-upon-Thames?"
There seemed to be more blood than one skinny African boy could possibly have had inside him. It went on and on. that guard lying there, with sand covering his eyeballs and his neck gaping, as if it was hanging on a hinge, wide open. It looked like a mouth. This very calm, middle-class voice in my head said, "Pac-Man! Pac-Man! Oh, gosh, he looks just like Pac-Man!" We all stood in silence as we watched the guard bleed to death. It took the longest time. I remember thinking, "Thank God we left Charlie with my parents." When I lifted my head, the killer was watching me. It wasn't a mean expression. I have seen checkout girls look at me like that when I forget my reward card. I have seen Lawrence look at me that way when I tell him I have my period. The killer was watching me with an expression, really, of mild annoyance.
"This guard died because of you," he said.
I must have felt things back in those days, because tears were running down my face. "You're crazy," I said.
The killer shook his head. He made a steeple of his fingers around the handle of the machete, held it up so that the point aligned with my throat, and eyed me sorrowfully along the trembling axis of the blade.
"I live here," he said. "You were crazy to come."
I began to cry then, out of fear. Andrew was shaking. Kindness began to pray in her tribal language. "Ecken emi Maria," she said. "Gratia ju I obi din veni non yeli. I enwe engozi kali ikporo, enine na engozi dili enwa afo ibu Jesu." The killer looked up at Kindness and he said,
"You will die next."
Kindness looked back at him.
"Enso Maria enene siuku," she said. "Yo niel anyi bu endi enjo, kita enubosi enke onwu anyi. Amen."
The killer nodded. He breathed. I heard the cold surf in ebb and resurgent. The brown dogs left off the carcass of the killed dog, and they came closer. They stood with their legs trembling and their hackles up, the blood stiff on their fur. The killer took one step toward Kindness, but I did not think my mind could survive seeing the machete cut into her. I said, "No, please, please leave her alone." The killer stopped, and he turned to me and he said,
"You again."
He was smiling. Andrew said,
"Sarah, please. I think the best thing we can do here is to..."
"To what, Andrew? To shut up and hope they won't get round to killing us too?"
"I just think this is not our affair, and so..."
"Ah," the killer said, "not your affair."
He turned to the other hunters and spread his arms.
"Not his affair, him say. Him say this is black man business. Ha 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 ha."
The hunters laughed. They slapped one another on the back, and the dogs started to circle us. When the killer turned back, his face was serious.
"First time I hear white man say my business, not his business. You got our gold, you got our oil. What is wrong with our girls?"
"Nothing," said poor Andrew. "I didn't mean that."
"Are you a racist?"
Racist was how he pronounced the word.
"No, of course not."
The killer stared at Andrew.
"Well," he said, "you want to save these girls, mister."
Andrew coughed. I watched him. My husband's hands twitched. His strong, fine hands I had often watched, gripping coffees, clicking across keyboards, making deadlines. My husband, who had filed his Sunday column from the departure lounge of the airport the previous day, down to the wire as usual. I'd been scanning it for typos when they called our flight. The last paragraph went, "We are a self-interested society. How will our children learn to put others before themselves if we do not?"
"Well," said the killer, "you want to save them?"
Andrew looked down at his hands. He stood like that for a long time,
Above us, seabirds circled and called to one another in that agonized way they have. I tried to stop my legs from shaking. "Please," I said, "if you will let us take the girls with us, then we will do whatever you want. Let us all go back to the compound, please, and we will give you anything, money, medicine, anything." The killer made a high, shrill yelp, and a shiver shook his whole body. He giggled, and a dribble of blood escaped through his neat white teeth to splash down onto the dirty green nylon of his tracksuit top.
"You think I care about that stuff?" he said. "You don't see this hole in my neck? I am dead in 2 days. You think I care about money and medicine?"
"So what do you want?" Andrew said.
The killer moved his machete from his right hand to his left. He raised his right hand with the middle finger extended. He held it, shaking, 1 inch from Andrew's face, and he said,
"White man been giving me this finger all my life. Today you can give it me to keep. Now cut off your middle finger, mister, and give it to me."
Andrew flinched, and he shook his head, and he curled his hands into balls. He folded the thumbs over the fingers. The killer took his machete by the blade, and he held the handle out to my husband.
"Do it," he said. "Chop, chop. Give me your finger, and I will give you the girls."
A long pause.
"What if I don't?" "Then you are free to go. But first you will hear the noises these children make dying. You ever hear a girl dying slow?"
The killer closed his eyes and shook his head unhurriedly.
"It is nasty music," he said. "You will not forget. Maybe one day you will wake up in Kingston-upon-Thames, and you will understand you lost more than your finger."
Little Bee was crying now. Kindness held her hand.
"Do not be afraid," she said. "If they kill us today, we will eat bread tonight with Jesus."
The killer snapped open his eyes, and he stared at Andrew, and he said,
"Please, mister, I am not a savage. I do not want to kill these girls."
Andrew reached out his hand, and he took the killer's machete. There was blood on the handle, the guard's blood. Andrew looked across at me. I stepped over to him, and I put my hand on his chest gently. I was crying.
"Oh, Andrew, I think you have to do it."
"I can't."
"It's just a finger."
"We didn't do anything wrong. We were just walking down the beach."
"Just a finger, Andrew, and then we'll walk back again."
Andrew sank to his knees in the sand. He said,
"I can't believe this is happening."
He looked at the machete blade, and he scraped it on the sand to clean it. He put his left hand on the sand, palm up, and he folded all the fingers except the middle one. Then he held up the machete in his right hand, but he didn't bring it down. He said,
"How do we know he won't kill the girls anyway, Sarah, after I've done it?"
"You'll know you did what you could."
"I could get AIDS from this blade. I could die."
"I'll be with you. I'm so proud of you."
It was quiet on the beach. Seabirds hung low in the hot blue sky, without flapping their wings, upheld on the sea breeze. The rhythm of the surf was unchanged, although the interval between one wave and the next seemed infinite. I watched with the girls and the men and the bloodied dogs to see what my husband would do, and it seemed in that moment that we were all the same, just creatures in nature, hanging without any great effort upon the vast warm wind of events that were greater than us. Andrew screamed then, and he chopped down with the machete. The blade made a whipping sound in the hot air, then it sliced down into the sand. It was really quite far from his hand.
"I won't do it," he said. "This is just fucking bullshit. I don't believe he'll let the girls go. Look at him. He's just going to kill them, whatever."
Andrew stood, and he left the machete in the sand. I looked at him, and that is when I stopped feeling. I realized I was no longer scared. and I wasn't angry with Andrew. When I looked at him, I hardly saw a man any more. I thought we would all be killed now, and it worried me much less than I would have expected. It troubled me that we had never got around to building the glasshouse at the end of our garden. A sensible thought occurred to me. How lucky I am to have two healthy parents who will take good care of Charlie. The killer sighed, and he shrugged, and he said,
"Okay, Mister made his choice. Now, Mister, run back home to England. You can tell them you came to Africa and you met a real savage."
When the killer turned away, I dropped to my knees. I looked straight at little B. She saw what the killer did not see. She saw the white woman put her own left hand down on the hard sand, and she saw her pick up the machete, and she saw her chop off her middle finger with one simple chop, like a girl topping a carrot, neatly, on a quiet Surrey Saturday, between gymkhana and lunch. She saw her drop the machete and rock back on her heels, holding her hand. I suppose the white woman looked just amazed. I think I said, "Oh, oh, oh!" The killer spun round, and he saw me with the blood welling through my closed fist. On the sand in front of me, there was my finger lying. The finger looked silly and naked. I was embarrassed for it. The killer's eyes went wide.
Oh, fuck," Andrew said. "Oh, what the fuck have you done, Sarah? What the fuck have you done?"
He knelt down and he hugged me to him, but I pushed him away with my good hand. There was mucus streaming from my mouth and nose.
"It hurts, Andrew. It hurts, you shit."
The killer nodded. He reached down and he picked up my dead finger. He pointed it at little B.
"You will live," he said. "The missus has paid for your life."
Then he pointed my finger at Kindness.
"But you will die, little one," he said. "The mister would not pay for you. And my boys, you know, they must have their taste of blood."
Kindness gripped little B's hand. She held her head up.
"I am not afraid," she said. "The Lord is my shepherd."
The killer sighed.
"Then he is a vain and careless shepherd," he said.
Then, and it was louder than the surf, there was the sound of my husband sobbing. 2 years later, sitting at my table in Kingston-upon-Thames, I found I could still hear it. I stared down at my damaged hand, spread palm down on the blue tablecloth. Little B had fallen asleep on the sofa, with her G&T untouched by her side. I realized I couldn't remember the point at which she had stopped telling the story, and I had picked up remembering it. I stood up from the kitchen table to fix myself another drink. There were no lemons, so I made do with a little squirt of plasticky juice from the Jif lemon in the fridge. When I picked up my glass, the ice cubes rattled uncontrollably. The G&T tasted vile, but it gave me courage. I picked up the phone and dialed the number of the man I suppose I must call my lover, although that word rather makes me squirm. I realized it was the second time I'd phoned Lawrence that day. I'd been trying not to. I'd lasted almost a whole week since Andrew died. It was the longest I'd been faithful to my husband in years.
"Sarah, is that you?"
Lawrence's voice was a whisper. My throat tightened. I found that I couldn't reply straight away.
"Sarah, I've been thinking about you all day. Was it horrible? You should have let me come to the funeral."
I swallowed. "It would have been inappropriate."
"Oh, Sarah, who would have known?"
"I would have known, Lawrence. My conscience is about all I've got left." Silence. His slow breath over the phone.
"It's okay to still love Andrew, you know. It's okay with me, anyway."
"You think I still love him?"
"I'm suggesting it, in case it helps."
I laughed, an almost inaudible exhalation of air.
Everybody's trying to help me today. Even Charlie went to bed without the slightest fuss.
It's normal that people want to help. You're suffering. Insufferable is what I am. It amazes me that people like you still care about me.
You're being hard on yourself.
Am I? I saw my husband's coffin today, being shunted about on rollers. When are you going to take a look at yourself, if not on a day like this?
Said Lawrence.
Not many men would cut off a finger, would they, Lawrence?
What? No. I definitely don't think I would.
My throat burned. I expected too much of Andrew, didn't I? Not just on the beach. I expected too much of life.
A long silence.
What did you expect of me? Said Lawrence.
The question caught me unprepared, and there was anger in his voice. My phone hand trembled.
You're using the past tense, I said. I wish you wouldn't.
No.
No. Please, no.
Oh, I thought that's what this call was about. I was thinking that's why she didn't ask me to the funeral.
Because this is the way you'd do, isn't it, if you broke up with me? There'd be a preamble where you reminded me what a difficult person you are, and then you'd prove it.
Please, Lawrence, that's horrible.
Oh, God, I know. I'm sorry.
Please don't be angry with me. I'm phoning to ask your advice.
A pause, then a laugh down the phone. Not bitter, but bleak.
You don't ask for advice, Sarah.
No.
No, not ever. Not about things that matter anyway. You ask whether your tights look right with your shoes. You ask which bracelet suits your wrist. You're not asking for input. You're asking your admirers to prove they're paying attention.
Am I really that bad?
Actually, you're worse. Because if I do ever tell you gold looks nice with your skin, you make a special point of wearing silver.
Do I? I never even noticed. I'm sorry.
Don't be. I love that you don't even notice. There are plenty of women who care what one thinks of their jewellery.
I swirled my G&T and took a careful sip. You're trying to make me feel better about myself, aren't you?
I'm just saying you're not the kind of woman you meet every day.
And that's praise, is it?
It's a relative praise, yes. Now stop fishing.
I smiled, for the first time in a week, I think. We've never talked like this before, have we? I said. Talked honestly, I mean.
You want the honest answer?
Apparently not.
I have talked honestly, and you haven't listened.
Around me the house was dark and silent. The only sound was the rattle of the ice cubes in my drink. When I spoke, my voice had a break in it.
I'm listening now, Lawrence. God knows I'm listening now.
A brief silence. Then another voice carried over the line. It was Lawrence's wife, Linda, shouting in the background, "Who's on the phone?" And Lawrence shouted back,
"Just someone from work."
Oh, Lawrence, as if one would throw in that just if it really was someone from work. You would simply say, "It's work," wouldn't you? I thought about Linda then, and how it must feel to have to share Lawrence with me. Her cold fury, not at the necessity of sharing, but at Lawrence's naivete in imagining that Linda didn't absolutely know. I thought about how the deceit must have acquired a certain uneven symmetry in their couple. I imagined the drab and ordinary lover that Linda would have taken in revenge, in spite and in haste. Oh, it was too awful. Out of respect for Linda, I hung up. I steadied the hand that gripped my G&T, and I looked over at little B sleeping. The memories from the beach swirled in my mind, inchoate, senseless, awful. I called Lawrence again.
Can you come over?
I'd love to, but I can't tonight. Linda's going out with a friend and I've got the kids.
Can you get a babysitter? I realized I sounded plaintive, and I cursed myself for it. Lawrence had picked up my tone, too.
"Darling," he said, "you know I'd come if I could, don't you?"
"Sure."
"Will you cope okay without me?"
"Of course."
"How?"
"Oh, I dare say I'll cope the way British women always used to cope, before the invention of weakness."
Lawrence laughed. "Fine. Look, you said you wanted advice. Can we talk about it on the phone?"
"Yes, of course. I... look, I need to tell you something. It's all got a little bit complicated. Little B turned up here this morning."
"Who?"
"One of the Nigerian girls, from that day on the beach."
"Jesus, I thought you said the men killed her."
"I was sure they had. I saw the men drag her off, her and the other one. I watched them being dragged kicking and screaming up the beach. I watched them till they were tiny dots, and something in me just died."
"But now? What? She just turned up on your doorstep?"
"This morning, 2 hours before the funeral."
"And you let her in?"
"Wouldn't anyone?"
"No, Sarah, most people would not."
"It was as if she'd returned from the dead, Lawrence. I could hardly just slam the door on her."
"But where was she then, if she wasn't dead?"
"On a boat, apparently. She got out of the country and came here. Then she was 2 years in an immigration detention centre in Essex."
"A detention centre? Christ, what did she do?"
"Nothing. Asylum seekers. Apparently they just lock them up when they arrive here."
"For 2 years?"
"You don't believe me?"
"I don't believe her. 2 years in detention. She must have done something."
"She was African, and she didn't have any money. I suppose they gave her a year for each."
"Don't be facetious. How did she find you?"
"Apparently she had Andrew's driving license. He dropped his wallet in the sand."
"Oh, my God. And she's still there?"
"She's asleep on my sofa."
"You must be completely freaked out."
"This morning I thought I was losing my mind. It didn't seem real."
"Why didn't you call me?"
"I did, remember? Your nanny was late. You were in a rush."
"Is she threatening you? Tell me you've called the police."
"No, it's not like that. She played really nicely with Charlie all afternoon. He was Batman, she was Robin. They made quite a team."
"And that doesn't freak you out?"
"If I started freaking out now, I won't ever know how to stop."
"But what's she doing there? What does she want?"
"I suppose she wants to stay here for a while. She says she doesn't know anyone else."
"Are you serious? Can she stay? Legally, I mean."
"I'm not sure. I haven't asked. She's exhausted. I think she walked here all the way from the detention center."
"She's insane."
"She didn't have any money. She could hardly take a bus."
"Look, I don't like it. I'm worried about you being all alone with her."
"So what do you think I should do?"
"I think you should wake her up and ask her to leave. I'm serious."
"Leave for where? What if she refuses?"
"Then I want you to call the police and have her removed."
I said nothing.
"Do you hear me, Sarah? I want you to call the police."
"I heard you. I wish you wouldn't say I want."
"It's you I'm thinking about. What if she turns nasty?"
"Little B? I don't think she's got a nasty bone in her."
"How do you know?
You know nothing about the woman. What if she comes into your room in the night with a kitchen knife? What if she's crazy?" I shook my head. "My son would know, Lawrence. His bat senses would tell him."
"Fuck, Sarah. This isn't funny. Call the police."
I looked at Little B, fast asleep on my sofa, with her mouth slightly open and her knees drawn up to her chest. I fell silent.
"Sarah?"
"I'm not going to call the police. I'm going to let her stay."
"But why?
What possible good can come of this?
I couldn't help her last time. Maybe now I can.
And that would prove what, exactly?
I sighed. I suppose it would prove your point, Lawrence, about me not being good at taking advice.
You know that's not what I meant.
Yes, which brings us back to my original point.
Which was what?
But I'm difficult sometimes. Lawrence laughed, but I think he was forcing himself. I put down the phone and stared for a long time at the long, smooth white planks of the kitchen floor. Then I went upstairs to sleep on the floor of my son's room. I wanted to be there with him. I admitted to myself that Lawrence had a point. I didn't know what little bee might do in the night. Sitting with my back against the cold radiator of Charlie's bedroom, with my knees bunched up under a duvet, I tried to remember what I saw in Lawrence. I finished my G&T and winced at the taste of the ersatz lemon. It was a small problem to have, a lack of real lemons. It was almost a comfort. I come from a family whose problems were always small and surmountable. We didn't have extramarital affairs in my family. Mummy and Daddy loved each other very much, or else they had hired failed actors to play the role of affable lovebirds in our family home for 25 years, and then kept those actors on a retainer so that they could be summoned back at the drop of a hat whenever one of their clients' offspring threatened a weekend visit home from university or a Sunday lunch with parents and boyfriend. In my family, we took our holidays in Devon and our partners for life. I wondered how it was that I had broken the mould. I looked over at my son, asleep under his duvet, motionless and pale in his Batman costume. I listened to the sound of his breathing, regular and solid and utterly asleep. I couldn't remember sleeping like that, not since I married Andrew. Within the first month, I'd known he wasn't the right man. After that, it's the growing sense of dissatisfaction that keeps one awake at night, the brain refusing to let go of those alternative lives that might have been. It isn't the strong sleepers who sleep around. But I was a happy child, at least, and my name was Sarah Summers. I still use Summers as my professional name, but personally it has lost. As a girl, I liked what all girls like. Pink plastic bracelets, and later silver ones. A few practice boyfriends, and then, in no particular hurry, men. England was made of dawn mists that rose to the horse's shoulder, of cakes cooled on wire trays for the cutting, of soft awakenings. My first real choice was what to take at university. My teachers all said I should study law, so naturally I chose journalism. I met Andrew O'Rourke when we were both working on a London evening paper. Ours seemed to perfectly express the spirit of the city. 31 pages of celebrity goings-on about town, and 1 page of news from the world which existed beyond London's orbital motorway. The paper offered it up as a sort of memento mori. London was fun. Men blew through like tall ships, some of them already wrecked. I liked Andrew because he wasn't like the rest. Maybe it was his Irish blood, but he wouldn't let himself be carried along. Andrew was the foreign news editor at the paper, which was a bit like being the wheels on a boat. He was fired for sheer obstinacy, and I took him home to meet my parents. Then I took his name so that no one else could have it. O'Rourke is a sharp name, and I imagined my happiness would soften it. But as Sarah O'Rourke, I lost the habit of happiness. In its place came a sense of amazed separation. The marriage was all so sudden. I suppose if I'd stopped to think about it, I would have realized that Andrew was too like me, that we were as stubborn as each other, that our admiration would inevitably become attrition. The only reason we were married in such haste was that my mother begged me not to marry Andrew at all. "One of you in a marriage has to be soft," she said. One of you has to know how to say, have it your way. That's not going to be you, dear, so it might as well be the man.